I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Grief is painful, which is why it's so difficult to talk about, and why we want so much to get past it, to get through it after someone we love dies. It is also inevitable. Psychotherapist Megan Devine watched her partner drown, and even though she had worked with her patients and their losses, she was not prepared to deal with the enormity of her own feelings of grief. She decided to better understand what the grieving process was all about and wrote about it in her book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay, where she writes that our culture does not make it easy to truly mourn. And she joins us on Radio Times by telephone. And Megan Devine, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Julie Cooper's mother died when Julie was in college, and that got her thinking about what to say at a loved one's funeral. Her book is The Last Word, Reviving the Dying Art of Eulogy. And who hasn't struggled over writing a eulogy or a letter of condolence or what to say at a wake or funeral? And Julie Cooper joins us from the CBC studios in Toronto, Canada. Julie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty, and it's Julia.
Julia, there you go. Julia Cooper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
In this hour, we're going to explore how people grieve, why our culture avoids talking about it. We also want to look at the ways that people console other people, what to say, what not to say, and how to celebrate the life of a departed loved one. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Megan, let me begin with you and begin with your longtime partner, Matt. You describe this was the summer of 2009, a fit and strong person, and you watched him walk into a body of water and you watched him drown. Horrifying to think about. What were the range of feelings that you had?
Oh, gosh. In that moment, I mean, it was one of those times where you feel like time just slows down to molasses. And I remember my strongest thought was, this is not happening.
Right?
I mean, there's a survival instinct that sort of goes in that rehearsing catastrophe, right? Like, what would you do in this situation doesn't really have any bearing on what happens in an actual emergency. You sort of go into autopilot. But I do remember that really clear thought of, this is not happening right now. Even as I ran into the water after him, and the dog ran into the water after me, thinking we were playing. Mm. And your body knows what to do to survive. And I got out of the water, and the dog actually got out ahead of me, which is why I got out of the water. And then we were lost in the woods for a while before we found a place where we could, a housing development where we could get a phone and call for help. And then it was 2 or 3 hours of rescue divers and search planes with the warden service before they found Matt's body in the water. And it's surreal. Yeah. It's not anything you can prepare your mind for. You don't know how you'll react to those situations. For me, there was a like a calm horror, right? That this is what happened, and here's what I need to take care of, and here's who I need to call. All while the universe is crumbling. It's a really weird experience.
I just scribbled down the word calm horror, and I will get back to you, Julia. Let me ask you about what happened when you were in college and your mother died. What were your range of feelings?
Yeah, very different than Megan's. And Megan, I'm so sorry just to hear that experience. It sounds not only hard but really traumatic. And yeah. I think that's a thing with grief, right? Yeah. Is I've been through a major loss myself, but nothing is like the experience you've been through, and nothing's like the experience I've been through. My mom was sick for 2 years with cancer, and so we had a lot of time to prepare for that loss and for the pain of losing her. But there was also a similar sense of, like you said, the universe crumbling and just kind of not being able to fathom really a world without that person in it. And that has taken years to still process. I think Partly what both of our books are interested in critiquing is the idea that there's some stages we could get through and get past and get over our loss. And at least for me, that's not been true.
Juliet, let me quote something you write in your book, and I underscored it several times. You write, I've never wanted to lose hold of my grief or to shake it off, even at the nadir of my despair, when I felt like there was no firm ground left to stand on. I knew I didn't want to get over it. And I think it says a lot about how you felt about your mother, clearly, but I think that's what makes grief so difficult. It's, on the one hand, it's our way of honoring and loving someone who has left us, but it's also painful and can make it sometimes difficult to figure out what to do with your life.
Yeah, that's exactly it, Marty. I feel really strongly that there's a pressure to move on, to get over your loss, to kind of pick yourself up by your bootstraps and kind of soldier on. And like you said, for me, grieving is loving and not wanting to let go of the love and the person that you cherished. And so to move on, to me, was actually almost a betrayal of my mom. So the task that I found before me was, how do I move on? How do I literally continue living, but keep her with me in some kind of way, in a culture that doesn't make a ton of room for that?
Megan, let me go back to you. And you're a psychotherapist, so clearly with your patients, you have dealt with their losses. Was it surprising to you how your grief was so unique to you, and maybe even with all your skills as a therapist, kind of threw you for a loop?
Yeah, it was a whole new world. There's a part in the book where I talk about after Matt died, and in my grief, I wanted to call all of my clients and apologize for not knowing what I was doing. And I know that's not accurate. I know that I did good work in the world, but there's something different about seeing it from the inside, right? And I love what you said, Julia, about, the culture wants you to move on, but why would you want to move on from the love that you share with somebody, right? That there's something pure about that. There's nothing wrong with being in pain. And, you know, I feel like I spent most of my professional life really listening, really being attentive to the deeper, harder places in people's lives. But I did have that idea that we wrestle through things and we come out the other side with different knowledge, right? And I think what's mostly different for me is I've dropped the second part of that, that life gives us what it gives us, and it's ours to carry. And there's really no goal of coming through something bigger, better, stronger, wiser. I think it's important that we not look for a happy ending or a transformation like that.
Let me quote you, Megan. And you talked with a lot of people who were going through the grief process, who had lost a loved one as you had. And you said that almost everyone felt, and I'm quoting here, quote, judged, shamed, and corrected in our grief.
Mm-hmm.
You also include a list of things not to say. I'll just read some of them. When someone is grieving and they have lost someone that they loved, do not say these things. Well, at least you had them for as long as you did. Or you can always have another child or find another partner. Or they're in a better place now. This will make you a better person in the end. Everything happens for a reason. Is there a way to banish those phrases from our culture? Go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about what we're saying there, even if it comes from a place of good intentions, and I kind of use air quotes when I say good intentions, even if your aim is to relieve somebody's grief or relieve their suffering, what you're really saying is, so don't feel so bad. Stop feeling how you feel. We say those things as a way to remove somebody else's emotions that are making us feel uncomfortable, right? These are things that we say when we feel helpless in the face of somebody's pain. That list of things you shouldn't say, there's a second half to the sentence there. And if you can add, after something you're saying to comfort somebody, if you can add, so don't feel so bad, it's probably not a good thing to say, right? At least you had them for as long as you did, so don't feel so bad. You can always have another child, so don't feel so bad. there's a judgment and a dismissal inside the things we commonly say to each other.
Julia, what did you find helpful to you when people talk to you about your mom or your grief or how you were feeling? Were there things that people said that were something that you wanted to hear and actually helped you?
No.
No? I was afraid you were going to say that. Now go ahead, Julia.
Yeah, I really wish I had a different answer. I wish I had a different answer for you, but I also wish there had been a different answer for, 19-year-old me. The truth of the matter is that no one said the right thing, but what was worse than someone saying the wrong thing was how many people didn't say anything at all. Mm-hmm. And to Megan's point, these phrases we use, like, at least you had them for this long, at least they didn't suffer, they are really painful to hear, and they're the wrong things to say, and I totally agree with that. But I think the people, at least in my life, that avoided it altogether, that was even more painful for me. I, like you said, I was at college at the time, and I went back to school. I was going to a small liberal arts college, and I remember the secretary, it was the first time I was seeing her since I'd come back from losing my mom, and she said, I heard about your mom, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get some comfort. I'm going to get an adult in my life who's going to say the right thing, finally. And she said, oh, I can really understand what you're going through. It's so much paperwork.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah.
And it obviously shocked me at the time, but years later, I ended up actually writing about it in the book because I was so angry and hurt at the time for that someone would say something so stupid. But I also, in hindsight, appreciated how honest it was that losing someone is a logistical nightmare. And that's also another part of the process that nobody talks to you about. And so though it was crass and kind of the totally wrong thing to say, she also said something that no one else around me was saying.
And I do want to talk about what we should say, but let me quote you again, Megan, because you include anti-grief narrative and bizarre things that we hear. You were told that you weren't a very good feminist because you were upset over, quote, losing a man. You were told that my personal and spiritual development must not have been as good as I thought if I couldn't find the gift in this situation. Those are just absolutely horrifying things to say to someone. And we will talk about what to say, the right thing to say when someone is dealing with grief. We do have to take a very short break. Talking with Megan Devine, she's a psychotherapist, wrote a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. Also the founder of the website Refuge in Grief. Julia Cooper is a writer, author of a book called The Last Word, Reviving the Dying Art of Eulogy. An explosion of comments at radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with our guests Julia Cooper and Megan Devine about grief, the grieving process. Let me read a couple of comments and then Megan, I'll put this to you and then Julia, I'll put this to you as well. One from Jonathan. My suggestion to people is don't feel obligated to say anything. Say what you're moved to say and not say or just show up like at a funeral without any preconceived thoughts or statements. Sometimes just seeing you is enough and there's no need for words. So the question to you, Megan, is how do you suggest being with someone who is grieving?
That's such a big question. Yeah. I want to reflect on something Julia said about how often people say nothing at all. And I think that's really common. We're not sure what to say, so we don't say anything because we're afraid to mess it up. And as Julia mentioned, that can be really hurtful. It can feel like, I'm over here and the world has dissolved and my person is dead and nobody notices. Nobody says anything. So I love that comment of sometimes you don't have to say anything, but your presence is important, right? Words are such imperfect forms to express something this powerful, right? your presence is important. And it's true that sometimes, you know, a good solid hug is better than all the platitudes in the world. Your presence is important. I think I would caution people to not think that this is a get out of jail or get out of difficulty free card where it's better to say nothing. Well, no. It's always better to show up and be imperfectly present. I love the idea that it's okay to say out loud that you don't know what to say, because that's true, right? Julia, you mentioned, like, I love the fact that what she said was true, even though it was unskilled, right? It's okay to show up and say, I have nothing to say, and I'm here, and I love you, and here's a casserole.
Yeah, don't forget the casserole.
Don't forget the casserole.
Julia, does I'm sorry, is that helpful?
Sure. I think, you know, to Megan's point, I love this phrase of being imperfectly present. If I'm sorry is all you can think of to say, then I mean, I'm sorry too that I lost my mom, you know, and I'm sorry that Megan lost Matt. It is an honest kind of response. And just to build on what Megan was saying, I think we don't make a lot of room for discussions of death in our society. And so when the time of death comes, when the funeral comes, people feel a lot of pressure to say the right thing or to say something. And so they slip into cliche and platitudes. And I understand that. It's a hard conversation to have. But part of what I'm wondering about in my book is, what if we talked about death and grieving more? What if we carved out a few other places to reflect on it so that there wasn't this pressure that people felt to come up with new and original words when the time of death actually comes?
Let me read some more comments. One from Lisa Beth. There's so many people hurting out there. As a songwriter, I've found time and time again that the grieving process comes through in melody and lyric. I can't really explain it. It never happens in a contrived way, more like flooding emotion that gets channeled into a song, yet are so uplifting. Also a tweet from CP. Ever since I was a small child, I would laugh at funerals. I would either say funny things about the deceased or the absurdity of the situation. And it's interesting. I have to say, at funerals, I have cried my eyes out and laughed my head off, sometimes at the same funeral. Megan, does that seem disrespectful? And I have to say, I'm not alone in this.
No, you're definitely not alone in that. And again, I think we get into tricky territory when we say there's a proper way and an improper way. Because when we say that, we set ourselves and other people up to pass or fail, and that's really not fair, right? I think showing up and being honestly moved in any direction, as long as you're not harming anybody, at a funeral or a memorial service or a wake or, you know, any of those things, like, we're being human. And if we're being honest with our emotional response, right? Like, when somebody laughs, sometimes it gives somebody else permission to laugh. Sometimes things are funny.
Yes.
Right? We're not one-dimensional beings. And when, you know, when you're, and Julia's going to be able to speak much more to this, but, you know, when you're eulogizing or memorializing somebody, it should include all of the things, right? It's not weird to laugh at a funeral. It's not weird to cry at a wedding, right? I think it's tricky when we start talking about any emotional response short of harming somebody else as problematic.
Julia, I do want to talk to you about eulogies, and I'm wondering whether your book, The Last Word, is your eulogy for your mother. But as you said earlier, since we don't talk about death very much, and oftentimes it's just a couple of days between someone dying and their funeral when you have to give a eulogy, what is a eulogy? What, for you, what makes a eulogy meaningful?
Well, it does actually build off what Megan was just saying, is that we kind of need to allow ourselves for the full range of emotions that comes with loss. And so for me, a eulogy isn't just the highlight reels of a life. It's not just the received notions and ideas and kind of recycled platitudes, but that it's really a chance to bear witness to someone that we loved. And I think testifying to a life is one of the most kind of caring things that we can do. And I also think it's one of the hardest. And I don't kind of wish the task of a eulogy on anyone because like you mentioned, Marty, there's a couple days for you to prepare it. You need to feel like you can encapsulate an entire life in a few moments, and when you yourself are still in the throes of it. And so there's it's a pretty tall order, a eulogy. And it's funny because I talk in the book about different movies or shows or books where we see a scene of the eulogy, and The Big Lebowski is one of my favorites, partly because we see the absurdity that you were just talking about, with John Goodman kind of standing on the cliff trying to eulogize his friend whose remains are in a coffee canister, and he just slips into these kind of crazy platitudes that are cliches that we all kind of use around death. And although it's totally absurd, it's really tone deaf. It's also an act of generosity on his part. He's really trying to memorialize his friend in that moment. And so there is no right way to do it. There is no perfect script.
Megan, anything you want to add to that? And then we'll get some callers in on the conversation.
Yeah. And I love what you said, Julia, about like we don't practice this stuff. We sort of see this as this rarefied thing, and here's this deeply important moment or series of moments, and we're asked to learn a new skill when the stakes feel really high. So the time to be talking about how we feel about each other, how we feel about the losses we carry every day, the pain of the world, how we talk about this stuff matters. Finding ways to sort of practice having emotional conversations or challenging conversations or owning the fact that we don't know what to say. We get lots of chances to do that in everyday life. When somebody dies or has a catastrophic accident or a serious illness, like, I don't want that to be the first time that you've wrestled with something emotionally challenging that you need to put into words. Practicing this stuff in daily life makes these big, deep, universe-changing experiences just a tiny bit easier. And if you can make it something so painful a tiny bit easier, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Julia, just one quick reference to your book. You include Norman Mailer writing the eulogy at his own funeral, and it's pretty funny. It's very Norman Mailer-ish, or Mailerian, or however you say that. Norman Mailer passed away yesterday after celebrating his 15th divorce and 16th wedding, and he goes on from there. I mean, obviously, putting some humor and sarcasm into his own eulogies.
Mm-hmm. And he highlights the things that we don't talk about, right? Who gets the money? Where does the money go? And he says it's going to be split between his many offspring, right? And although it's really funny and it's satirical and he kind of brings out some discussions that maybe we don't always have, a piece like that also kind of suggests that we can dictate the terms of our own story even after we're gone. And I think kind of the loss of control that we're confronted with around death is something that is really hard to swallow for most of us. And so we maybe plan our own funerals, maybe we pen our own obituary, maybe we try to divide assets and try to control these things that really, once we're gone, we're gone.
Yeah. Out of our hands. That's mm-hmm. Julia Cooper. She's a writer. She wrote a book called The Last Word, Reviving the Dying Art of Eulogy, joining us from the CBC studios in Toronto, Canada. Megan Devine joining us by telephone, and she's a psychotherapist, wrote a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. She's the founder of the website Refuge in Grief. Let me get actually an anonymous caller joining us from Philadelphia. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
A couple of things come to mind with this terrific conversation. Part of this, we've got culturally an addiction to joy and an addiction to competency, which fundamentally, that's the heart of the right to die movement is control over death. And with our one of our biggest fears, obviously, around it is being entirely forgotten. And I think of that Disney movie, Coco, you know, where they celebrate Day of the Dead. You know, that speaks to something that we so don't have in our culture, this capacity to bring with us our ancestry and live in the presence of our dead, even when they are dead. And to that end, when my mother died about 8 years ago, I was lucky enough to be in the death trade at that time. And I had the wisdom and the wherewithal to speak with the funeral director. And we made arrangements so that I would collect my mother's bones following her cremation. Now, 8 years ago doesn't seem that long ago, but actually in terms of the death positive movement, it's might as well have been 50 years ago, right? Oh. We've got the death cafes and death duels today. But at the time, you know, it took some negotiating with that cremation operator. And I have my mother's bones in a box in my house, in my bedroom. I have a wooden box with the bones of my mother because we stopped the cremation process before it was complete. And I was able to bring with me this
That's
in Delaware.
That's really fascinating. And I really appreciate that because I want to put that to both of our guests. In fact, Julia, you saved a shopping list that your mother was in one of a pocket, I think, of perhaps what she was wearing or in one of her clothes. You have her shopping list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't want to forget the trivial things about my mom. And so, you know, our caller has these relics of her mom that actually remind me of the last chapter of Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild, where she talks about actually swallowing a bit of her mom's ashes as an attempt to keep her close. And I think it just resonated with me, that kind of a powerful kind of connection there. But for me, I didn't want to forget what her handwriting looked like. I didn't want to forget that she needed soy milk and toilet cleaner. You know, I wanted to remember these little things that with time just kind of fade away. But also when you add them all up, that's what makes the person.
She also made a really interesting point about joy. And both you, Julia, and you, Megan, recognize or acknowledge Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote a book about essentially the tyranny of positive thinking. And as I read both of your books, there it was. You both were underscoring what Barbara Ehrenreich was saying. But Megan, can you speak to that about how this, as she describes it, this tyranny of positive thinking doesn't allow us to truly grieve?
Yeah, and I love the caller's line, addiction to joy in this culture. And I really think that's the deep problem here, is that we believe and we've been taught and we've reinforced that happiness and joy are states of health. And that if you're not experiencing joy, if you're not experiencing happiness, you are unwell and it's your own fault, right? Because happiness is it within reach for everyone. That's problematic in a lot of ways. But that addiction, that attachment to positivity, if you're unable to find a positive spin to whatever you're experiencing, in our cultural ideas of health and wellness, you're failing, right? If you can't put a rosy spin on something, it's your fault. And, you know, sometimes when I talk about that, I get some pushback, like, that's not really true. Like, the option is to be, you know, if you're not thinking positive, then you're a curmudgeon, you're a constitutional Eeyore and always looking on the dark side of things. And that kind of binary, like it doesn't work for a lot of things that involve being human. The opposite of always being positive is not always being negative. There's some middle ground there, which is called being human. And being forced to be positive, that addiction to joy, goes against the reality of living here. Sometimes things hurt. Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. No, I really appreciate what you're saying there. And I'm thinking for you, Julia, I'm not sure how many years ago your mother died. Do you still feel you grieve for her?
Mm-hmm. I definitely feel like I still grieve with her, and that grieve for her, and that process has evolved a lot over the years. And I think at first I did feel this impetus to be happy, not really for my own health and wellness, but so that I didn't impinge on the happiness of others. Mm. I felt this pressure, almost this ethical duty to be happy, so as to not bring anyone else down. And I think my grieving process would have been a much a richer one for me if I hadn't been so concerned about making other people more comfortable around my loss.
That's a lot to bear.
It is. It really is. And the only solace was knowing, wow, a lot of other people must be feeling this too. And if they're not feeling it yet, they're going to.
Megan, how about for you? Do you still grieve the loss of your partner?
Or how do you
feel that grief, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Yeah, I love that first, Julia, you said grieving with your mom.
Yeah.
Right? Like that the relationship doesn't end because the life ended. Mm. I work with a lot of folks who, they've lost their parents at a young age, and you don't just lose somebody at one point in time. You lose them forward in time. You lose the future that you could have had, right? Mm-hmm. You lose the parent who can watch you grow and become each new person you will, right? It's not a static event. So today, at the time that we're talking, I'm about 8.5 years out from Matt's death. And he's still present for me. You know, my life is... very different than it was back then. And I still have moments where I'm like, I want to show him what's happened and what's changed. You know, I can still hear his sense of humor making fun of me for very specific things, right? Like, it changes. One of the things that I'll often tell people, especially in those early days of grief, is that grief doesn't stop, it gets different. Because I think that people worry, as you said in the very beginning of our conversation, Julia, what happens when I don't feel this so intensely? Mm-hmm. Does it mean I've betrayed my person?
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about grief, the many forms of grief, with Megan Devine and Julia Cooper. And with you, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about the various ways that people grieve, why our culture avoids talking about it, also looking at ways to console people, what to say, what not to say, and how to celebrate the life of a departed loved one. Our guests are Megan Devine, a psychotherapist, author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay, and Julia Cooper, author of The Last Word, Reviving the Dying Art of Eulogy. Let me read some comments here, and then we'll get Bertha from Chester to join us. Richard said, as a Christian, I find that even churches and pastors have trouble talking about death and the hope that Christians have in Christ. As a result, instead of funeral services, churches now hold celebrations of life services. It's important to acknowledge the person's life, but that's not all that the service should be about. A comment from Peggy, a young group of designers in Philadelphia has created a, quote, game for opening conversations about death and dying in our family or community. Interesting. A voicemail from Ron, I just noticed the correlation between laughing at funerals and in the very fine line between instance laughing, and I've noticed some, I'm losing track of exactly what he's saying there. A comment from Lisa, sorry about that. I lost my dad. A friend said, be gentle to yourself, allow yourself to mourn. That's pretty nice. Let me get Bertha from Chester to join us. And Bertha, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you once again for a fantastic talk.
Oh, thanks,
the topic.
Bertha.
I just wish the whole world could hear.
We're trying.
My point is, I've lost both of my parents. I am now in my early 60s. And this was around, my father passed, I guess, in my early 30s. But the point I want to make is, I wish I had done for him and his service that I did for my mother. They were both beautiful services, funeral services. But what I did for my mother, I actually took pictures of her in her casket.
Oh.
Because in my mind, that's all still part of the circle of life. If, you know, she had a beginning and here's the end. And I also had someone audio tape her funeral service with the idea that I would like to listen to it later. And my story is that... a couple of years after she passed, I tried, and I couldn't listen to it. A few more years passed, and I tried, and I did listen to it, and I was so happy that I had it, because there were pieces that I had forgotten about while I was sitting there crying, missing her. But I was able to actually, I guess you say, quote, enjoy her funeral service. And it meant so much to me that I could still hear all of that. And so I try to pass that on to other people, you know, gently. And I know there are people who videotape their funeral services and that kind of thing. But the point is that as the two speakers have said, you know, you want to keep the person with you. And she's with me all the time because I can hear her last service.
Oh,
so
Bertha.
I just wanted to throw that out.
I'm glad you did, Bertha. Thank you so much for calling into Radio Times. Megan, anything you want to say in response?
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I love that idea of sort of doing things in the moment for your future self.
Huh.
Right? There's so much that just sort of washes over us in those early days. And, you know, a recording that you may or may not ever listen to is actually a really lovely idea. Right? I know a lot of people keep the last voicemail from their person or, you know, a recording of them. And maybe you can never look at it. Maybe that's too painful. But knowing it exists can be a little bit of a comfort.
Julia, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Bertha's story was so beautiful. I think the idea that let's not worry about what we think we should do when the time comes to bury our dead. Let's think about how we can make that ritual our own. And like Megan said, do something kind for your future self, because grieving doesn't happen in a straight line. And at least for me, I'll be grieving until the day I die, and it's a part of my life. And so I think if we maybe even have some of these conversations before the time of death comes, then you don't have to, in the moment of in the throes of your own grief, try to come up with ideas for how you want to continue to bear witness to your loved one.
In fact, you both say, both you, Megan, and you, Julia, say in your books that there really isn't these stages of grief. I mean, Kubler-Ross said that early on. Megan, it seemed like she perhaps took that back. But the idea that first you go through this, and then you go through that, and then you go through that, and then you come out the end. You're saying, Megan, and I think others have said as well, it just doesn't work that way.
It really doesn't. I understand the desire there to put form to something formless, right? There's so much helplessness. The emotions are so big and so deep. And, you know, as we said, all of us have said, you know, the universe shifts so much. Of course we want to map to that. The trouble with that is, one, humans don't work that way, right? There's no set of stages that's going to make things easier or give you guidelines. I think the real damaging thing of the stage model is that it gives our friends and family, our clinicians, all of our support people, it gives them this pass-fail idea, this image of those steps and those stages. It gives us a tool by which we can judge somebody else's heart and somebody else's grief. And it's like right intention, wrong tool. Right. And when we lean on those stages and say that there's a right way and a wrong way and you have to go through this way or do this, it makes us miss each other. It's a really cruel, tool, in my opinion.
And it sounds like, Julia, you pretty much agree with Megan, the notion of these predictable stages of grief.
Yeah. What's interesting about Kubler-Ross is she gets short shrift, I think. She wrote these five stages as part of the beginning of a much longer and more thoughtful piece of work. But what's interesting is that American readers in particular took those five stages as gospel. And I think they wanted the map, like Megan said, to have in their back pocket to pull out when the hard times arrived, and so that they would have a clear step-by-step guide on how to get through loss. And I can relate to that desire to know what to do when loss washes over you, to literally, what foot do I put in front of the other now? And I think that's why maybe we do grasp onto cliche and we do look for self-help type fixes to the problem of grief, but it's just as much a part of life, and that's something I think we need to carve out more space for.
Let me get Paul from North Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I had a two-part question. The first is, like, what do you do if you work in a profession? And, for instance, I do harm reduction, but it could be the military, hospitals, where you're just surrounded by death. Mm. And you're trying to figure out a way to comfort people. And the second one is, you know, we also process a lot of this stuff on social media these days. And somebody will post, you know, X person died, and everyone's saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And I just feel like that's so trite. I had to, like, personalize it in some way, but I also wonder if sometimes that might not be so appropriate.
Two really important questions, Paul, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me pick up on the last one about social media, because I think we've all observed it. Someone dies, and then there are all these messages and messages of condolence in many kinds of ways. Julia, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and in my book, I actually talk about the rise of that on social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook, especially when a celebrity dies, because something at least peculiar to me happens, which is we get this huge kind of outpouring of micro-eulogies, I guess you could call them. And you might want to say that's a good step towards making the topic of death less taboo, at least we're speaking about it. But I think, hopefully to your caller's point, I think what's a bit insidious about that is that you get this model for how to grieve, which is really loudly, really publicly, really quickly on social media. And that the same impetus to kind of get your grief out there, get it circulating like content, maybe make it go viral, but then get over it and let's move on to the next news cycle. That's what at least gets under my skin about this kind of social this performance of grief that we're seeing on social media.
And get likes for it, I guess. That always comes
Well, it's an exchange, right?
It is
a very kind of commercial exchange that happens, and that Facebook and Twitter, I mean, they're profiting off of those imprints, even if they're tear-stained.
Let me read some more comments. An email from Anne. I occasionally write letters to my mother. Interestingly, an email from Beth in Wilmington. When my boyfriend of 20 years died, several friends said to me, there are no words, and left it at that. An email from Linda. Let me put this to you, Megan. She says, how long will the tears still come when talking about the past, the loved one who has passed? It can be embarrassing. Is there a time limit on crying over losing a loved one?
Gosh, there isn't, right? I mean, tears are normal, right? I think the reason why we feel embarrassed when we're doing that is one, the way that our culture treats grief, right? It's messy, clean it up. A lot of people don't tell the truth about their grief or any other, you know, intense emotions because of the response, right? That we know we're making other people uncomfortable. And that's where that embarrassment comes in. Tears are going to come up. They're going to happen. There's no end to that well, right? Dehydration is a serious issue if you're
dehydration, really?
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. Right. Like you wouldn't believe how much water the body can produce without drying up.
Actually, I do.
In those early days of grief, drink a lot of water. But really, you know, tears are just, they're one of the ways that the body has of processing emotion. And I also understand that there's definitely a place where, like, I am just trying to get my groceries and get out the door, and I don't want to be overcome by sadness or longing right now. And that's really valid too, right? So it's more a containment of, can I find a way to get myself through until I can get to a place where it's okay to let these feelings out, more than how can I stop the tears from happening, right? More situational, less trying to make them stop altogether.
Sure. We have been talking about death, and I mean, that is really hard to talk about. But I think for a lot of people, I want to get response from both of you. there's the dying part, and you know, I've been through this myself. I know people who are going through this or have been through this as well. When someone is dying, or they're in hospice, or you know that the future doesn't look bright, but you don't know exactly what it is, and that's a really difficult time, Julia, and to you, Megan, to have a conversation about. Well, maybe it's the right time to have a conversation about important things. What are your thoughts, Julia?
I keep coming back, actually, to Megan's phrase of being imperfectly present. And I think that's such a nice mantra to kind of go into those conversations with, is that there's no good way to have that conversation. There's no easy way to talk about your own death or the death of someone you love. But you know, life isn't always about the easy conversations. No. I think that something really important can come out of that. And so maybe just being imperfectly present and being unspeakably kind to yourself, maybe those things might help.
What do you think, Megan?
I love the idea of leading with curiosity, right? If you're sitting with somebody who is facing their own death, I think, again, because of that intense feeling of helplessness and wanting to say the right thing, we can actually accidentally silence the dying person, right? So doing that imperfectly present, right? Showing up and being curious, how is it today? Do you want to talk about what this is like for you, right? Being really mindful that we don't decide what the other person wants to talk about. And making it clear that whatever that person wants to talk about or process or discuss is okay with us, right? Letting them lead and coming into that situation with curiosity. It's super helpful. It's uncomfortable, but it's super helpful.
We have so many people that want to join us and no time. I'm looking at two screens that are basically here filled up. And this may seem like a weird segue, but I wonder whether when our the cats and dogs and animals that live with us, when they die, whether that's actually a good time to try to understand what grief is about and what loss is about and mourning. Julia, what are your thoughts?
I honestly think grief comes in all shapes and sizes. A friend of mine wrote me a message after she'd read my book and said, "This was so helpful. I just lost our family pet." And my first instinct was like, really? The book about my mom dying is like your cat being dead? But in hindsight, I thought, I get it. You know, I love my dog like way too much. And I get that grief looks and feels differently for all of us. And there's no hierarchy of grief. No one's, you know, it's not a competition of pain. And so I think anything that we love fiercely and we love deeply can teach us about what loving them beyond death might look and feel like.
Well, we could go on. Clearly, there's a lot of interest in our conversation. Julia Cooper, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been lovely. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. She's a writer, author of The Last Word, Reviving the Dying Art of Eulogy. Megan Devine, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a psychotherapist, wrote a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. And she's the founder of the website Refuge in Grief. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.